acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 87, Do the Math, Sunday, August 23rd, 2015. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. This week's episode includes the following segments: On the Porch, Yarn Lover at Large, Ever Expanding Skill Set, Off the Shelf, and so forth. Welcome to Linda, who is Lynn2804 on Ravelry and hails from Oxford, UK. Thanks for introducing yourself on the Ravelry thread. Linda mentioned that she had heard about the Yarns at Yin Hu podcast after Jasmine of the Knitmore Girls mentioned it. So if you're like Linda and you're giving Yarns at Yin Hu a try after hearing it mentioned by the Knitmore Girls, welcome and thanks for tuning in. It's been a very busy week at Yin Hu. I have just another week left before the school year begins. So I've been trying to just do all of those things that make summer special and important to me, including spending some time with my mom in her garden and her kitchen, working on projects, and spending a lot of time outdoors. One of the elements of summer that we've been missing is that no wrens have nested around the house this summer. I don't know where they are. We usually see them nest at least once, sometimes two or three times, and they're just so friendly hopping around on the porch. I've heard some wren song, but the wrens have really been scarce this summer. Lately, however, in the evenings, we've been hearing the beautiful trills of the eastern screech owl. This happens right around dusk. Sometimes, though it's very rare, you can make out the outline of the owl in the trees. You can see them just before they're about to fly and take up residence in another branch. Mostly, though, we just hear them, and sometimes, if I can get it just right, I can get the owls to sort of respond to my imitation of their call. It sounds like, kind of a trilling, purring sound. And if they catch it just right, or maybe if it's muffled enough that they don't recognize it's me, not another owl, I can get them going. There are usually two. It's difficult to tell because they move around in the branches a lot, but usually there are two or maybe three that are kind of calling back and forth to each other in the dusk. It's just a beautiful part of this time of year. And lately, maybe the past three or four nights or so, the sounds of summer have started to mingle with the sounds of fall around our house. One of the most notable is the sound of acorns from an enormous oak tree right next to the house that drop and roll down the steep roofs of Yin Hu. And that sound is bittersweet because it brings all the excitement of the things that are autumn, but also the loss of the hot and hazy days of summer. I hope you're enjoying the weather and the sounds and sights of nature wherever you are. On the Porch. I've been working on two projects this week. One, I believe I mentioned last time. I am almost finished with the Dotted Rays shawl, a design by Stephen West. I'm using some hand-dyed yarn that's been mill spun, as well as my own spindle spun yarn to create a kind of ripple effect, I suppose, in this shawl. I'm using US size 6 needles, and I haven't mentioned, but I did purchase one pair of the collage circular needles that are the squared shape needles. They have very, very pointy tips, and I find them quite comfortable, especially in working with the hand spun yarn. And I find, since I only have one pair of these and they're in US size 6, I find myself gravitating toward patterns that would call for a size 6 so that I can use them. They're quite comfortable in my hands, and I find that I can knit for a longer amount of time without fatigue using those needles. US size 6, US size 4, 5, and 6, I suppose, are much more comfortable for me than any other size, either smaller or much larger. So that might have something to do with the amount of comfort I feel with those needles. However, I do think that the shape of the needles has something to do with it. So in the future, I may invest in a few more pairs of those in different sizes. Otherwise, I tend toward Addy needles. I haven't mentioned much about the needles that I use or done any product reviews. I tend not to make any big investment in needles. My local yarn shop, Mountain Knits and Purls, stocks a variety of Addy needles and now the collage as well. So I tend to just pick up what I need there. I don't have an interchangeable set or anything like that. As far as double pointed needles go, I am strictly sets of bamboo needles. I don't have any metal double pointed needles. I feel like they would be a little bit slippery and slide out of my project. And usually I'm only using double points to make something very small, which isn't a very big time commitment, or to complete a project like the end of a hat or something like that. I'm hoping that the Dotted Rays shawl will be a big shawl and something that will be a great transition from spring to summer to fall. It's in lovely sky and ocean colors, kind of sea greens and heathery blues, that sort of thing. And I think it will be completed within another day or two. Another project that I've taken the time finally to get started is a weaving project using the 15-inch Cricut loom that I brought home from school. This was a loom that I purchased with the grant money I was awarded this past spring. And the objective with that loom is to help my students use it to weave some of their hand-spun yarn. I've said it on the podcast before, but I will continue to say this, because I feel so strongly that a loom warped with sturdy black yarn and using beautiful hand-spun yarn as the weft is one of the best ways to showcase hand-spun that I can think of. Certainly for my students, I like this idea because weaving with hand-spun makes your yarn last longer than knitting and certainly crocheting. And they work so hard to make this beautiful yarn. It's a shame to see it used up so quickly in a project where they're knitting or crocheting. They've also been working on spinning some beautiful gradients and transitions over the summer. And so I think this would be a good way to preserve the beautiful transitions in their yarn. And so, you know, it can be showcased in a woven piece. And I've used a loom before. I have an old Becca loom, but I wanted to become adept, I suppose, or at least moderately skilled at warping the Cricut loom so that I could help the students do it without any trouble. Emily of the Fibertown podcast mentioned that there was a Craftsy class available. When I checked out Craftsy, the course was on sale. And so I purchased the course. I don't recall the name of it, but the teacher is Angela Tong. She is very clear about a number of steps involving the Cricut loom, and I have not watched the entire course. She does some more complicated weaving of dish towels on a larger loom. Right now, that doesn't interest me, and patterns in weaving don't interest me. I was primarily concerned with how to get the loom warped, because the last time I had attempted it with my Becca loom, I had a major fail. My confidence was shattered, and I sort of procrastinated about it all summer. However, finally, when I set up the loom, I did this on the porch, so I had plenty of space and light. I have a cone of sport weight black yarn. It's incredibly strong, and there's a ton of yardage on it, so I think it will work well. I set up the warping peg, which is a wonderful addition to this loom. It's something I don't have for the Becca loom. And there's also a very useful worksheet for figuring out the yardage needed for the width and length of scarf or project that you want. So how much yarn you will need for the warp and how much yarn you will likely need for the weft. I love this idea of the worksheet because I think it's something that I can do with the students and really teach them some skills that I guess go beyond any particular project into more of the conceptual nature of weaving and what that means. It will also allow them to see how long their project needs to be in order to showcase that entire length of yarn. So I think they'll have to do some trial and error kind of math to figure out the length of scarf that would allow them to use all of their hand spun and not call for any additional hand spun. So I like that. I thought the video on Craftsy was very clear as far as how to warp the loom and what to look out for. I completed all of the steps without any snags. And then I started weaving with some 3-ply Corriedale hand spun from my own stash. The one thing I did not think was so great about the Craftsy video was the directions for how to finish a project after taking it off the loom. The instructor has you sort of undoing part of the project and pulling out scrap yarn. I did not follow those steps of the process. I like to start weaving with some strips of paper towels, and that allows the warp to even out. Then I use some of the warping yarn and weave about 10 rows of that for the beginning of the project, and I repeat that at the end. So rather than starting the project with the weft yarn, I just start with a little bit of black. This helps to even things out. I think it gives a nice balance, and it also makes a nice transition between the weft of the project and the fringe that might be hanging on the end. It also seems to me, in a lot of the woven products that I've purchased, I have some woven scarves and things, that this is the way of it, that the very first rows of weaving use the same yarn or the same color of thread as the warp. I also am a firm believer in beginning and ending the project with a hem stitch. There's a video tutorial on YouTube that I think is very well done. And I don't wait to do the hem stitch on the beginning of the scarf. I complete it right away when I'm just a few rows into the weaving. And then I do the ending hem stitch before I take the project off the loom. That way you have nice tension on your project because it's actually on the loom under tension. And I just feel like it gives everything a nice crisp finish. It's also a logical place to decide on what your fringe will look like, how many pieces of fringe will be together across the length of the scarf. So I've linked to the hem stitch video in my project notes for this particular weaving project, and I highly recommend checking out that video. I always forget exactly how to do it, so every time I do a weaving project, I have to watch this video to remember how to do the hem stitch. But I think it's very neat and tidy, and it just gives a woven project such a nice finished look. Yarn lover at large. Yesterday, I had the pleasure of taking the Math for Hats workshop at Mountain Knits and Pearls, my local yarn shop. And Math for Hats was taught by Kate Oates. You may know Kate Oates as Tot Toppers. That's her handle on Instagram, I think on Ravelry. And I think that she is best known for her amazing collection of patterns for hats for kids. Adorable, just make your teeth ache, adorable hats for kids. And then some of the patterns sort of lend themselves to hats for more mature folks. So she has different kinds of sizing depending on the pattern. Mountain Knits and Pearls is currently hosting the trunk show of Tot Toppers. I think they're like two different collections of patterns. And so all of the hats from those collections are on display right in the front of the shop. It's like an adorable setup for the trunk show. And then there's also a collection of sweaters for boys at the shop. Kate had not seen this trunk show for a while because it's been on tour. It's been going around from shop to shop. So I think it was really a treat that she was able to pull hats from the show to tell us about all kinds of different techniques and calculations while she was explaining them during our class. The class was 4 hours. There was a lot of information, but Kate was incredibly skilled at breaking up segments of information so that nothing felt too overwhelming. She was able to give individual attention to every member of the class, and boy, is she smart with math and smart about making it easy and digestible when you're in the class? We learned so many things. It's difficult to step back and think about some of the major points. I guess overall, the objectives of the class were to make math more friendly and less intimidating, and to encourage us to think about how to use math both to get an existing pattern to fit and also to think about what calculations would be important in the design of a hat. And she talked about her own designing process and when different tricks and strategies would work and when they wouldn't. Underlying all of the things she taught us was her own investigation of math for hats. And part of that is this pretty extensive survey she did to find out what is the actual sizing, what are the inches and centimeters for different heads at different ages. And she did a pretty extensive survey of a number of folks to find out, you know, what those average inches and centimeters are. And then she had us take measurements of one another and compare our measurements to those that she had compiled. I never thought about the fact that your ears are not really on the sides of your head. So if you measure from ear to ear around the back of your head, that distance is much shorter than ear to ear around the front of your head. And also, you know, where the crown of your head is located and what that means in terms of fitting a hat. Just a lot of things I hadn't really thought about. And these points made me more aware of why some hats have been more successful than others in terms of the hats that I've knit for myself and also for other people, because I think hats are a great gift. I think they can be a really fun element of style, you know, for your wardrobe or just maybe for a special occasion or just a special gift. I think they make a great gift, but the important thing is to think about the wearer and making sure that hat will fit and what adjustments you might have to make as you're knitting the pattern. So we all had our pens and pencils and our calculators and our measuring tapes. She also taught us how to figure out weight per stitch and weight per square inch of a knitted hat, so you could figure out if you have enough yarn for a project. I thought that was very interesting. She had her digital scale with her and just sort of, I left with my head spinning with ideas and not really feeling very taxed about doing the math. So I think practical applications for math are very exciting and interesting. I wish we had maybe more of that in our school system. I think some schools are making bigger strides in that direction, and that's really exciting that students see practical applications for the mathematics that they're learning and that it's not just an abstract thing that seems not very useful. I highly recommend Kate Oates' patterns. The finished projects that were on display in the shop are just adorable. And she's also working on some new patterns that I think will be incredibly interesting. We had a sneak peek of some leg warmers and a hat to match that have just a beautiful little chevron pattern and fringe. These leg warmers are so cute. Oh my goodness. So she was working on that a little bit before she started teaching the class. There was just great camaraderie and conversation and a really good time. If you have the opportunity to take a class at a local yarn shop or at a knitting event, I encourage you to do it. It's just a great way to expand your understanding, even if it's something you think might not interest you. It's amazing to find out when you get this very experienced knitter and designer in front of you, what kind of information they will dole out that may not even be something suggested by the class description, but you get going on a topic because someone asks a question or they start dispensing wisdom because just some tips and tricks occur to them, and you end up really leaving with a lot of great suggestions and inspiration for your own crafting. Ever expanding skill set. This week, I visited my mom and spent some time in her kitchen and her garden dealing with end of the season bounty, particularly with tomatoes. We canned a batch of salsa and a batch of tomato sauce. I took some photographs of her completed canning. She usually lets everything rest on some flat surfaces upstairs, and then she does damage control, sort of organizes and cleans out the storage space she has in her cellar. And then she transfers all of the canned produce from the summer downstairs, usually in one day. She'll do all of that. So she leaves everything upstairs until she's ready to clean up, clear a space, maybe get rid of any old jars or look to see if anything from previous seasons has spoiled, organize things, and then transfer the newly canned products to the basement. My mom gives a lot of her canned things away as gifts, but sometimes things accumulate or she just doesn't use as much of something as expected. And she needs to stay on top of that. I was also surprised that she has been reading a great deal about new advances in canning and what the collected wisdom is these days in terms of science related to canning. She learned to can and had sort of her tried and true ways of doing things for a very long time. But now that she's been using an iPad and she's been able to Google things and do a lot of research online, she's found out that there have been some advances and some changes in philosophy about canning in the past 20 or 30 years or so. And she's trying to get up to speed on all of that and sort of processing it through her collected wisdom as well. So, in particular, we were talking about some of the new guidelines in terms of sterilization of jars, also, what makes jars weak and likely to break. I've certainly had some periods where I feel like every time I would can something, I would break at least one jar. And we were discussing possibilities for why that might be. And then we picked some additional produce outside, and I went home with some tomatoes and also some peaches. And I'm not sure if I'll be canning these, but I made sauce from the tomatoes, just a small amount that maybe I'll just keep in my refrigerator and use up. And then I let the peaches ripen and cut them all up and put them in the freezer for use later on. Even if it's only a small amount, it just feels like something special to preserve some of the sweetness of summer and store it for a later season when there's not so much variety available. Something else I wanted to mention is a recipe that I've been making all summer long, which is homemade ginger ale. And I've been calling mine ginger mint. What I've been doing is making a simple syrup using water and brown sugar. I like the deeper taste of brown sugar. So 1 cup water to 1 cup sugar. And then I bring that to a boil, let it simmer for a few minutes. And then toward the end of the simmering, I add a few tablespoons of very finely chopped ginger, as well as some freshly picked mint. I let that simmer for about 2 or 3 minutes. Then I remove the pan from the heat and just let that steep for an afternoon over the course of an evening, and then I strain it off and put that in a jar and store it in the refrigerator. To make ginger ale, I just add a few tablespoons of that syrup to some seltzer, and then I might add lime, or if I want more of an adult beverage, then I add a shot or two of bourbon to that mixture. And that, I think that sort of a drink is referred to as a mule, but it's just a wonderful, refreshing summertime drink. And I've been making batches of this ginger mint syrup all summer long. So if you have those ingredients on hand, I highly recommend giving that a try, or maybe even trying some different fresh herbs. Like, I think this would be interesting to do a basil syrup, or maybe something, I don't know, maybe something with sage or thyme, and then adding it to some kind of cold beverage, and maybe your spirit of choice. Off the shelf, our summer read-along of Color, A Natural History of the Palette by Victoria Finlay, is nearing its conclusion. And over the past 2 weeks, I've been reading about blue and indigo. These are action-packed, adventurous chapters. I was so intrigued with Finlay's visits to Afghanistan to investigate blue. And then I was particularly interested also in the indigo chapter. So I'm going to read a little bit about indigo. I had never thought about this idea that the colors of the rainbow and our assignment of Roy G. Biv is rather arbitrary. There's some illuminating writing about the work of Isaac Newton in this department, and the allure of the number 7, which may have been the key inspiration for why we have these 7 colors in the rainbow, even though they may not all be apparent when you actually look at the rainbow. It never occurred to me that that would be some kind of arbitrary notion that we just seized upon. But I thought I'd share with you today a little bit of history in the form of Eliza Lucas. I had never heard of this historical figure, and she is very important to cultivation of indigo in the United States. She's a remarkable figure in the story of indigo. Born in Antigua, where her father was an officer in the English army. In 1738, when she was 15, she, her parents, and her sister Polly went to live in Charlestown, which she described happily in letters as the gayest town in South Carolina. A reputation it maintained, as it was to be the place where the scandalous Charleston dance was invented in the 20s. The plan was to start farming the three plantations they had inherited from Eliza's grandfather and to make a new life away from the battlefields. But in 1739, Lieutenant Colonel George Lucas was drafted back to Antigua in preparation for what everyone realized was to be an inevitable showdown with the Spaniards. Eliza's mother was ill, or at least hysterical, but for him to refuse the commission would have been treason, so he left Eliza in charge of the farms. Father and daughter would write to each other often, and their letters would become part of America's heritage, even though they would never see each other again. Eliza was also the mother of some of her country's earliest political sons, Thomas and Charles Cotesworth Pinckney. But she was also notable because of indigo. Eliza Lucas Pinckney is portrayed in American history books as a certain variety of nation's mother, an 18th century example to her 20th century sisters. She is usually shown as an enlightened young woman who educated her slaves, put family duties first, and most importantly, embraced with calm fearlessness those American virtues of risk-taking and hard work. Eliza's connection with indigo began in 1739 with the arrival of an envelope from Antigua, from which a handful of yellow seeds spilled out. While Eliza was a pragmatist and her mother was a doubter, her father was a dreamer. George Lucas conjured up images of lucrative crops springing fully ripened from the paper twists of seeds he would send tucked into his correspondence. One time he sent alfalfa, another time he believed ginger plants were going to solve the Lucas cash flow problem. But the one idea that really triggered both their imaginations was indigo. "I have greater hopes for the indigo than any of the rest of the things I have tried," she wrote. The first harvests were wildly unsuccessful for two reasons. First was the weather. "We had a fine crop of indigo seed upon the ground, and the frost took it up before it was dry," Eliza wrote apologetically. "I picked out the best of it and had it planted, but there is not more than 100 bushes of it come up." The second reason was more worrying: sabotage. In 1741, George sent a man called Nicholas Cromwell to help Eliza process the dye, to ferment it in vats and dry it into cakes for export. Cromwell, however, did not want her to succeed. After all, why should he compromise the value of his own family's crop back home? And he deliberately ruined the vat. "He made a great misery of the process, said he repented coming, and threw in so large a quantity of lime water as to spoil the color." Eliza recalled this many years later in a letter to her son Charles Cotesworth. At the time, she had told her father that Cromwell was a mere bungler and had fired him. The following year, she tried again. Eliza was nothing but determined, and to her dismay, the crop was eaten by caterpillars and shriveled by the sun. The fourth year was even worse, and it was only in 1744 that Eliza produced South Carolina's first successful harvest of indigo. Later, she gave seedlings to other plantation owners on the theory that if they were going to grow enough South Carolina indigo to supply the needs of English dyers, then they needed to present a united front. By 1750, England was importing 30,000 kilos of indigo from the Carolinas, and by 1755, the export total had reached nearly 500 tons. But this was not the first time that indigo had been grown in the Americas. There had been some attempts by the settlers in the Carolinas before, and other indigo crops had been grown in other southern states. Eliza would have known about these, but perhaps she did not know that other indigo species had been used traditionally by Native Americans, and that they might have withstood the weather and insects better than her imported seeds. Well, I enjoyed learning about Eliza Lucas, and I've also been tending all summer long, tending some indigo plants that I've brought with me from the Fibercraft Studio at the Threefold Center in Chestnut Ridge, New York. There are some beautiful gardens, and in particular, a dying garden located near the studio. And the folks who have been our teachers seem to also take a great part in tending that garden. There were some plants and seedlings for sale during the spring months, and I brought home 6 tiny indigo plants. These are Japanese indigo, and I'm looking forward to learning a little bit more about Japanese indigo and why Japanese indigo as opposed to other varieties when I return for our first session in the fall. I believe we will be dying with indigo during the September or October sessions. I think there was some talk about Japanese indigo being more suitable for a northeastern climate than the varieties which might grow, for example, in South Carolina, where there's a little more heat and winters aren't as harsh. I brought 6 plants home. One immediately struggled and died, but the other 5 have really been thriving. I planted them in a very sunny spot. There's not a lot of sun at my house, but I found the sunniest spot I could. And then I fortified the ground with quite a bit of compost. And it's been a little bit of a dry summer, so I have done some watering of the plants. And they've really become quite lush and full. Now they've started to flower, and I'm not sure if I should be pinching those flowers back or allowing them to flower. So I might send an email to my teachers inquiring about what to do as the season progresses. And I can't wait to maybe use some of these plants for dyeing or to see what process is used when we visit Fibercraft Studio in the fall. I know that we will be dyeing from the fresh leaves. I don't think that we will be fermenting indigo or making cakes to save. I think we're going to use processes similar that we've used with other leaves and flowers in the spring, that you make some kind of a dye vat and immerse your yarn or your fiber into that vat. I'm not sure either of the mordant process that's required for indigo dyeing, or even if there is one. So there's lots to learn, and I'm really looking forward to that. This week had an incredibly rainy Thursday afternoon, which I took complete advantage of as a sewing day. And I worked on a number of projects, including putting some shirring into the waistline of one of the staple dresses that I've made. I was really nervous about this step, and when I visited my mom on Wednesday, she kind of talked me through the process, gave me an idea of some things to look out for, and I was equipped with some elastic thread I had purchased at Nido in Burlington, Vermont. So I thought I would give it a try. My machine just worked beautifully with this elastic thread. I had read a lot and was really concerned about, hand winding the bobbin with the elastic thread, whether or not to put any tension on the elastic as I wound. I did not. I just wrapped it as loosely as I could without putting any stretch into the thread. And then I used the same thread I had been using for the rest of the dress as the main thread that went through the needle. And I was able to install 4 rows of this shirring with really no problem at all. My mom had given me the tip of making sure that I backstitched very securely on each round at the beginning and at the end, because what can happen is that the elastic can just let go. And then it's really not working in your dress at all. And the other important tip was just that, you know, the first installment of the elastic thread is pretty easy to do because your fabric is flat. But then any remaining rows that you're going to put in, you'll need to stretch out the fabric as you work that row so that you're not adding additional stretch. And then you would maybe have a dress that you could no longer put on because so much gathering had been taken up that there wouldn't be room to get into it. So definitely rows 2, 3, and 4 were a little bit more slow going. Nevertheless, I really enjoyed it. I could even imagine a dress where the entire top is shirred around the whole dress or maybe just across the front to give it a lovely fitted look. I don't know of a pattern like that, but I could imagine one. Maybe I'll look for one. And I'm even thinking now of adding a few rows of shirring to the first staple dress that I sewed at a pretty small size. And I was thinking, well, this is pretty small. I'm not going to put any shirring in the waist. But now I could see that it might be more flattering with a few rows, maybe just 2 or 3 rows instead of 4. I also have fabric to make another version of the dress. This is a beautiful cotton lawn. Oh, it's just incredible with a very unusual fabric. It's Sarah Watt's Mystery Meal. It's pink with an incredible print of an octopus all over it, quite large octopus all over it. I think I will make the version of the staple dress that does not have the drop hem. There's a version you can make that's just straight across above the knee length. So I think I might try that one for the fabric. And I also have some flannel fabric printed in a design by Anna Maria Horner. It's called Echinacea, I think. To me, it looks like coneflower. It's in reds and browns and blues. And I think I might try drafting my own A-line skirt and using this fabric to sew the skirt. I've been taking a look at Cal Patch's videos on Creative Bug. She has one for how to draft the skirt to your own measurement. And she has another one with directions of sewing the skirt. It doesn't seem like there are too many unknowns in doing that except for installing the invisible zipper, which I have not yet done. I've installed some zippers on project bags, but they weren't really invisible zippers. And I think there are some additional considerations for installing a zipper in a garment. But I think I'm ready to take that on. Another project that I completed was something I had started and then I was waiting for double fold bias tape. My mom had a whole bunch on hand. So I left with enough to complete one project and many more. And I was working on a shirt pattern, a blouse pattern, I forget the name of it, but it's in Heather Ross's weekend sewing book. I had cut this out and started the sewing, but then I was at a standstill until I had some double fold bias tape and I completed the pattern. I followed the directions and I didn't have any problem doing that, but I find the neckline of that top pretty uncomfortably high. There's a button at the top of the neckline, and if I were to make that again, which I'm not entirely sure I will make that blouse again, but if I do, I would alter the neckline so that it falls quite a bit lower. I mean, it's almost uncomfortable when you're seated in this top, and I end up unbuttoning the very top of it. I probably should have done a little more research by reading blogs from folks who had sewed this before, But I just went ahead and did it with some inexpensive fabric I had purchased at Joann's. So that's what's on tap for me as far as sewing goes. I was also able to put a new hem in some things that store-bought garments that I've had for a while but just weren't fitting properly. And it's just so much fun to have those sewing machine and be able to do some projects very quickly. I'm still finding that devoting an entire day or an afternoon to sewing works much better for me than trying to do a little bit every day the way I do with yarn projects. And my hope is that throughout the fall and winter, I can still manage to find time to work on things and work toward my goal of a mostly handmade wardrobe.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, flowery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves are down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. Just like Linda Curtis, a bird out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. Music for this episode is So Wheat. Music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. If you enjoy today's episode, I hope you will consider liking the show's Facebook page, joining the Yarns at Yin Hu group on Ravelry, or leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
Jump a river naked, hike a country mile. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.